Okay, we'll call the meeting to order now. Having enough people. Oh, we don't. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Representative Winkler moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. This is a discussion today which has come up. A lot of interest in this, not just obviously our issue is how this, what happens with the state, but you know there's a lot of interest on this obviously beyond the state, and so we thought it was time to have this hearing and let's find out what we're doing right or wrong and get some questions answered about how we can find out more about what's going on in the state. So Mr. Bicker, do you want to start, or do you want both of you together, or Mr. Bailey to start, or what? And we did give you, you did get our questions in advance. No, you didn't. So. It's all right. Little miscommunication.
No, Madam Chair and members. No, we were basically told it's kind of a free form. So,
okay.
Now, Jeff Bailey is the chairman of my investment advisory council, who advises the staff and the board on various investment-related policy. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the director of the investment board. Madam Chair, I guess, what would you like us to do?
Well, we kind of like to understand your investment strategy. We'd like to understand your division between active management and non-active management. I think we want to know something about the level of the number of active managers that you have, and and anything that you think is relevant to us understanding what's going on. We're also interested in the relationship with your primary investment consultant, Richards and Tierney of Chicago, who's been listed, and we don't think we have enough information about how that goes. So once you start, we'll probably come in with questions as you.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, I'll start, and then if Jeff Bailey can add or whatever. First of all, the State Board of Investment invests a number of different asset pools. The majority of our assets are obviously retirement-related, but we also invest a number of different pools, the Environmental Trust Fund, Permanent School Fund, Stein Risk Plan, we do all the state cash management, and a number of other things. I assume what you're most interested in is our retirement-related assets. We have set up a long-term asset allocation for those assets that we believe in the long run will provide a strong return for those assets. We have an 8.5% assumed target. Our asset allocation currently is 45% domestic equities, 15% international equities, 20% alternative assets, 18% bonds, and 2% cash. We have, over the years, maintained a very strict discipline in the sense of rebalancing back to those asset classes as the markets move. We have actually, in the last few months, bought some more equities and sold some fixed income. That wasn't very profitable the last couple months. It was better today. The market was up 300 the last I saw, so there's some hope out there. As far as how we run individual asset classes, our domestic equity asset class, for example, has approximately two-thirds of either passively or risk-controlled, and one-third actively managed. That active component has approximately 15 managers. Our fixed income component is basically half actively managed and half risk-controlled managed. The risk control is done with three managers, and the active is done with five. International, again, we have a passive component, a risk control component, and an active component. The passive is obviously one manager, the risk control is three, and the active is about seven. The alternative component is comprised of various private equity, venture capital, real estate, mezzanine debt, and resource managers. There are a number of managers, and it will look like there's more than there really is, because we'll do Fund 1, Fund 2, Fund 3, Fund 4 with the various organizations, because these are each individual limited partnerships. And then we have one cash manager. You know, we have over a long period of time had relatively decent performance going into this fiscal year. Over the last 28 years, we've compounded over 10%. Now, again, this year has not been a very good year. The retirement-related assets are down approximately high 20s or around 30% for the first 8 months of this fiscal year. Again, that will be be determined, the funded ratio and return as of June 30th, which is the end of our fiscal year. So, Madam Chair and members, that's kind of a quick overview of the retirement-related assets. I could do other ones if you'd like, or you can ask Mr. Bailey whatever you'd like also.
I guess we'd like Mr. Bailey to talk to us about what he thinks the Investment Advisory Board's position is, what he thinks. Now, suppose we ask the question of the State Board of Investment's broad approach or strategy to investing. And, you know, you kind of give us a rundown to it. Is there any other philosophies? Like, is there any use of mutual funds? Is there any some of those?
Sure.
Aspects.
Members of the committee, I think the approach the State Board of Investment takes is actually relatively commonplace among pension funds. My day job, I'm the director of benefits finance at Target Corporation, and I think if you took a look at it, you'd see our pension fund look very similar to the State Board's retirement assets. And those, certainly that approach of having a relatively large equity component with the idea of trying over time to earn returns that lower the cost of running the fund is a fairly standard notion. And certainly in periods like this, it doesn't look like a very good move, but over the long run, that sort of equity exposure has been the appropriate policy. I think in terms of the manager alignment and so forth that you see in the State Board of Investment, I think, again, that is relatively standard. The idea of hiring a number of managers rather than just one manager to run the assets is the idea behind that, of course, is that you don't want one manager running all your money and potentially making mistakes and that causing big trouble for the program. And diversifying across managers is, I think, a very effective move. The State Board of Investment is always looking at the cost of that program, and I think the ability of the State Board of Investment to hire managers with the large number of dollars it has been allowed it to drive management fees down really about as low as they're going to go for active managers and for passive managers. Madam Chair, you mentioned mutual funds. I think the biggest problem with mutual funds is they're quite expensive, and you get essentially the same sort of managers and the same results, but you get them in a much more costly way.
So the example, the question I asked is, does the State Board of Investment have any use of mutual funds in their investment portfolio?
Madam Chair, in the retirement-related assets, no. I mean, because, I mean, say we got Fidelity. We have Fidelity run an international portfolio for us for about 0.2%. If you hire a mutual fund, it costs you over 1%. Then you get the same performance. Actually, you get lower performance in the mutual fund because you pay a higher fee. We do use mutual funds in the state's deferred comp plan because of the need for daily movements and individuals. That is standard operating procedure. We don't have those kinds of individual funds for individual choice that the state deferred comp plan wants and requires.
How about the replacement and the dismissal of active members? How are those, how many active managers have been dismissed in this year, and, you know, why were they dismissed, and what's the time lag between hiring replacement ones, and how are those decisions made? Are they made by you with consultation with the advisory board, or what?
Madam Chair, obviously we monitor managers on an ongoing basis, and termination decisions are a joint decision reached by staff, the advisory council, and ultimately the board makes the final vote on those. Last year, I believe, one equity manager was terminated and one fixed income manager was terminated. The fixed income manager was terminated because the firm literally was in the process of moving from one city to the other city, from Philadelphia to New York, and they were going to lose a lot of their people. And we didn't want to be sitting there holding the bag as these people left, so we moved those assets to a new management. The equity firm merged with another firm, and again, from an operational standpoint, we didn't want to take those risks.
One of the things that we've talked about having different active managers is that on any day you can have, you know, with different approaches to portfolios, is that on any day you can have one manager selling something and the other manager has a different philosophy buying the same thing. And the state ends up with the same stock platform, but out two sets of transaction fees. How do you know whether that's happening or not?
Well, certainly that can happen. I think the whole notion, though, of having a number of different managers, again, as I pointed out, is you have some diversification of active management judgment. In other words, if you gave it all to one manager, yes, they would only be doing one trade, but that trade would have a big impact on your investment program. Well, by splitting it up, to the extent that you have managers that have some skill, you're going to have a diversification of judgment, and in the end, you'll have a lot lower risk in your portfolio.
What do you do about oversight? Do you have a check to see how often that's happening?
Well, Madam Chair and members, we look at all the transactions, and there has been occurrences when that's happened, not necessarily the same day. But we also minimize that in the sense that we don't have all of our managers managing the entire stock market. We have small cap growth managers, small cap value managers, large cap. So when we say we have 50 managers, they're not all buying and selling IBM. IBM is generally considered a large cap growth company. So the three or four managers in that area would be the only ones participating with IBM. So it's not as though all of our managers had the same set of securities from which they select. That's another way that we control everybody doing the same thing. As you said, if they are all buying and selling the same stock, all we're doing is making a broker rich. But we control that very much by having the market broken up into subsets that they specialize in.
What about, do you do any looking at the results of investment manager tracking? You track them, you look at their results, and is that ever made public?
Madam Chair, we do that quarterly and it's published quarterly.
Now,
it's also published in the annual report.
And I would point out that the review of the managers takes place at the Investment Advisory Council level on a quarterly basis, and those results are reported to the State Board of Investment as well. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for transparency in terms of manager performance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the domestic securities are two-thirds passive. I get two questions. I guess, what is the breakdown of active versus passive management on international securities? And then what do you do for the passive portion?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I said two-thirds were either passive or risk control.
Okay.
So one-third is straight passive, or approximately one-third, slightly higher than one-third. And approximately one-third is what we call a risk control manager, which we set risk parameters around the market that they can operate in. So in other words, they're not taking large bets, they're taking a lot of very small bets. So that's two-thirds of our equity program. As far as the international program, approximately 40% of it's passively managed straight, and approximately 15% of that is obviously risk control. The balance is actively managed.
Does passively managed mean the index?
Index, yes.
Okay.
Index and passively managed are.
Okay. We require Minnesota Public plans to have a statement of investment policy to look at their investment activity. Does the State Board of Investment have a statement of investment policy?
Yes, we do, Madam Chair.
Is that
published in the annual report? Oh,
okay, we probably should have had copies of the annual report here. I don't, we've probably all been sent them at some time.
Madam Chair, you probably got them today. They just came up. Yes, we were ready. We were waiting something called the auditor's opinion before we could publish. We've been sitting around waiting for about 6 weeks.
Then I don't feel so badly about not having. Do you have a copy with you to answer some of these questions?
Actually, I didn't bring one along. We actually have most of them are on compact discs these days instead of in paper.
Okay.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Baker, for coming today. Just out of curiosity, can you explain, I know the market has, except for maybe today, I've heard it's kind of gone up pretty significantly today, actually. Can you talk about maybe how the market has affected the pensions and maybe decisions about investment? And I know that there's been a loss, and you've been in a couple of interviews in the major papers, and but I'm just wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, maybe how long it may recover. I mean, there's a lot of people, whether it's state employees, teachers, that have a lot of interest in this, and maybe this isn't the right time for that kind of, okay. It's
anything.
Madam Chair, Representative Biggs, a couple of things. First of all, when we talk to retirees, there's no need to panic. I mean, we still have in excess of $30 billion in the retirement-related assets. Our payroll from the sense of sending out retiree checks net on a monthly basis is approximately $100, $150 million. So, I mean, we're in good shape. We are not in a panic mode. That being said, we have sustained losses like everybody else has. So this has not been fun. And we, like everybody else, I shouldn't say everybody else, we believe that this country will rebound. There was extreme excess. There was extreme greed in this country, and especially on Wall Street. And greed and leverage led to some severe market corrections and I mean, I used to say when I went to New York, I go to New York maybe once a year, I used to see the investment bankers and spend 3 days with investment bankers. I don't have to worry about that anymore because there aren't any. There are none left. So, what do I think is going to happen in the future? I think we're going to end up better off than we were before. I think a lot of the excesses, a lot of the greed, the over-leveraging of various financial organizations will be changed. I think there will be a lot of regulation coming out of Washington. Probably too much, but that's the way the pendulum goes, from too little to way too much. But I think we will be a better organization. The Pension Commission asked me some of the same questions a few weeks ago, and Representative Kahn said, well, I still got to remember there was something called Graham and Dodd. Well, I think we're going to get back to Graham and Dodd in more an overall scope for retirement. And that's basically Graham and Dodd is get back to basics, get back to fundamentals of what makes this system work and what makes this country work. There's going to be some pain in between. Now, there has been a lot of pain. Are we at the bottom? I don't know. I can't make that call. If I could make that call, unfortunately, Madam Chair, members, I wouldn't be here. I'd be out raking some money for myself. But we think that we will be fine in the long run. There's been some major dislocations, and it's going to take time to get these things corrected. I think the current administration has done some things very well. I think they've done some things very poorly. But in the long run, I think we'll be okay.
President Polk. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just I'm not one who believes in government by Dow, that we shouldn't watch the stock market and make our decisions based, you know, and have a ticker on the, when we do the House, the new House voting board to keep up with the Senate, we shouldn't have the stock ticker on there. But but I do believe that the Dow actually does respond to public indicators, and I don't think it's a surprise that the market responded with a 5% jump to news this morning that President Obama named a friend of Minnesota, Van Jones, as the senior advisor for green jobs.
At least now I know why it happened. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, sir, I have a question. There seems to be some disagreement as to what category to put index funds in, but what is the State Boards of Investments policy on investing in index funds, and also have they done anything about, maybe having their own set of index funds?
Madam Chair and Representative, we index assets to various asset classes. I mean, we index international to something called ACWI, which is the All World Index. We index domestic ACWI assets to something called the Russell 3000. These are standard indexes that are used by just about everybody in the country. So our policy is basically to have separate accounts. We don't want to be in commingled funds. And the reason we don't want to be in commingled funds is we can negotiate lower fees. Commingled funds probably pay anywhere from 15 to 30 basis points. My international program, I run for 0.03%, and the domestic, I think it's 0.02%.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this has been discussed, just let me know. I came in a little bit late, but on that issue of fees, how much on average, if there is such a thing, I suppose, what is a typical year, how much in fees does the Board of Investment pay, and do you measure that, do you measure success based on a set dollar amount or as a percentage of the overall portfolio, or how is that, how do you look at that?
Madam Chair and Representative, first of all, our costs for everything we do, all the managers, even our rent, is approximately 11 basis points. So the whole operation runs for around 0.1%, and that can vary depending on assets and so on and so forth. As far as a measure of success, our performance, every number you will see from the State Board of Investment and any report or whatever, is net of all of those costs. So we net everything out before we publish any return data. So everything you see from us is net of all costs.
And Chair, just a follow-up then. You mentioned before someone asked you a question about, I think it was the Chair asked you a question about certain mutual funds. So to what extent do the fees play a role in deciding what to invest in? Is that a minor factor, a major factor?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, for example, in an active equity manager, fees is a big thing. If I'm looking at a mutual fund versus a separate account, because I can do a separate account for at least 0.5% cheaper. And so therefore, if the manager gives you the same return in a mutual fund as he does in a separate account, I'm going to get a half, or the state's going to get 0.5% higher return because of the cost. So we are cognizant, very much cognizant, of the cost of our managers. Now, some areas in the investment world are very expensive. Some you can negotiate down to be very inexpensive. We try to control our overall cost as much as we can. I think we probably have somewhat of a well-deserved reputation around the country as not giving away the ships. And we argue pretty long and hard with our team.
Madam Chair, are the fees mostly by transaction? Are they as a percentage of the overall transaction? Is there a flat fee? I'm just trying to get an understanding, and maybe there isn't one answer.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, the transaction fees, the cost of doing a trade, are borne by the manager within their own account. And so their net performance already has, you know, the commissions and trading market impact. The fees that I am talking about are the management fees that we actually write them a check and pay them for.
One of the questions that I've got is, and I don't know if you can, I don't know if this is in the annual report or if we can, but what if we want to look at the time-weighted total rate of return for the retirement fund assets invested by SDI actively compared to those invested semi-passively and those invested passively over, let's say, the last quarter, the last year, the last 5 years, and so forth? Is that some information that you could give us, and is that publicly available?
Madam Chair, that's in the annual report.
Okay. Can you give us anything?
Madam Chair, over the last 5 years, domestic equity managers have slightly underperformed the index over the last 5 years. Until a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago, fixed income managers outperformed, and international, I think, slightly outperformed also.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Speaker. I trust Manchester Perry is doing okay. I'm not used to seeing you without him.
Madam Chair. Yes, he is. He's in. Matt Scopera used to be the assistant director. He's now running the state of Maryland. So.
Oh, okay. No. You trained him well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you look at that as on a competitive basis? Is Maryland doing better, or are you doing better, or don't you?
Matt
was
originally from the East Coast of the country, so he wanted to go back home, so he's happy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bigger, I think, you know, knowing that you already have a board with some high-level leadership that already oversees many of the things, but considering the times we're in, being the expert that you are, you know, what's the best thing for the State Board of Investment in regards to the next year to help protect our retirees? You know, what's the kind of your overall recommendation? Again, you may have covered this, but I still think it probably bear repeating.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Kipmeyer, as you know, you've served on the board for a number of years. The one thing that we have always done, and I think done relatively well, is maintain our discipline. When you're running a multi-billion-dollar pension plan, you cannot be a market timer. You cannot take unnecessary chances. You got to establish an asset allocation policy that you think is appropriate, that in my case, in the case of the State Board of Investment, that the Investment Advisory Council concur with, and that the board can concur with. And then you maintain and adopt that policy. If you feel there's a need to change it, then you go through the process of changing the asset allocation. But you don't make market timing decisions. If you look at the history, excuse me, Madam Chair, and members of the stock market, you know, I don't have all the exact, Jeff may have them, but yeah, if you look at the stock market, say, over the last 10 years, and you missed 30 days, you probably missed half the return. So if you want to market time, and you're not there, and I know some people have been out of the market, fine. They've been fine so far. They're not fine today. And I hope this thing rallies and continues to go so that we're all in better shape. But if anything that we have done, and we've done consistently over the last 30 years, is to maintain our discipline in how we run the money.
Madam Chair and members, I guess I would endorse that as well. I think it's a real cornerstone of any sound investment program is to have an investment policy that you're comfortable with, and you have to be comfortable with that in bad times and good times. And the worst thing you could do is, and so often we see it, is the bottom is bail out. Now, the bottom has been deeper than I think anyone would ever expect it, but at the same time, if that investment policy is something that you've spent some time working on and believe is in the long run in your best interest, you've got to be there. And a day like today is a good example. Market's up 5% today. I mean, if you're pulled out of the market in the morning, you're not going to be there for that return. So it's a long-term decision.
And Chair, just on a follow-up comment on that, probably one of the most telling examples is seeing that discipline in effect for those 8 years and seeing how the weighted portfolios that they have and what they do. And so the general thing is when they become unweighted, you're selling and buying. So usually you are selling at the higher end and buying others. And it's really kind of a fascinating dynamic to watch the discipline and each one of those categories so it's spread out. And and doing all of that is, you probably, when it's so large like that, you see it better than in some of your individual things. But that discipline, I think, has helped us over the years because we went through 2001. After 2001, I remember we just had to hang on like crazy. It was hard, but seeing that function as we went through that time, and we did, we were there when the time came around and adjusted the policy in accordance with coming around. And so seeing that function, which it is, you know, it is a discipline, and probably for you, Mr. Bicker, more than anything, holding on to that discipline is your hardest job, I think, in the role that you play there, and appreciate it very much. I'm glad you have trained others to follow in your footsteps, because it may look easy when you do it well. It isn't necessarily so when you're there doing it day after day. Thank you.
What's the role of the Investment Advisory Council? Does it take a role in setting the policy? Does it take a role in oversight? And kind of what's the membership? If you can give us some idea of the Investment Advisory Council, you know, with retired investment advisors and active ones and so forth. So.
The Investment Advisory Council is composed of a mix of individuals. There are several representatives from the state retirement system, the teachers in the state retirement system and the public employees, the retiree representatives. There are primarily the bulk of the composition of the Investment Advisory Council is professionals like myself who are running other large pools of money in some other walk of life. And so I think the goal of the Investment Advisory Council is primarily to bring oversight and advice to the State Board of Investment. We're not involved on a day-to-day basis. We can't know about all the nuances of each individual manager that the staff is dealing with. But it's important, I think, for the Advisory Council to be there to be a sounding board for staff and also to provide the members of the Investment Board with the comfort that some other professional has looked at a lot of the decisions that are being made by the staff and backed up those decisions in the sense that they make sense from an investment policy standpoint.
Are there any times when you criticize decisions or second-guess decisions or suggest that
you've got to be kidding.
The meetings can be a bit contentious at times. In the end, I mean, the goal is to try to arrive at some sort of consensus, and many times we'll have split votes. I don't think that's unusual. But again, I think the goal of the Investment Advisory Council is to provide solid feedback from professionals and interested parties.
Madam Chair and members, the Investment Advisory Council, again, has 10 people from the local investment committee, which is the majority of the Investment Advisory Council. These people, as Jeff has said, run pension plans. They run the pension plans from Target, Cargill, University of Minnesota Foundation, 3M, General Mills. These people are anything but shy. And believe me, the advice and review that they give, recommendations and suggestions that come from staff are very much appreciated by the staff, and I can ask Representative Kiffmeyer when she's on the board, but I can ask any of the board members that they very much appreciate it. It gives a whole set of additional due diligence that most public pension plans don't have.
What about the whole issue of alternative investments and the private equity? How are those decisions? That's always kind of hard to make. I think those decisions are probably harder to make about buying and selling. How are those decisions made?
Well, Madam Chair, first of all, we set a long-term asset allocation for alternative investments. We have to be very careful. Some public plans and some endowment plans have had some issues in the sense that they have made significant investments in private equity and other limited partnership formats and have become overcommitted. In other words, they've got more commitments than they can fund. They lose their liquidity. You know, because we commit $100 million to a fund, they'll be taking that money down over, you know, 2-3 years. So we set disciplines not only on the market value, but how much money can also be committed. The reality is private equity, resource funds, mezzanine debt, these types of investments have had very, very strong returns for the boards over a long period of time. Now, are they going to have some issues in this environment? You bet they are. They're going to have some issues just like everything else is. One thing that we have done, and I hope we will continue to do, is when we make these commitments, we have very much made commitments to organizations that have been around for a while. We want to play with organizations that have a strong team that's been together. You don't want to make a commitment, a 5-year, 10-year commitment to an organization that got together 3 weeks ago. Because in 3 weeks, they may not like each other, and they may split up. And now you have a real serious problem because you've got money committed to an organization that you're going to have to really put back together. So our private equity, our venture capital, our alternative investments in general have been with what we believe are pretty strong teams that have been around for a long time. We've been doing it since the early 1980s, and we have had what we believe are pretty strong returns in the alternative area. And again, they are going to suffer, just like a lot of them, especially with some new accounting rules that are requiring them to mark stuff down that probably doesn't really need to be marked down as much as they're going to mark them down. But if you see the new accounting rules, it's going to have some effect also.
I think you'd like to get into this issue of the relationship with Richardson and Tierney and what seems to be sort of the lack of transparency of it. They give you things with the copyright righted documents and so forth.
Madam Chair, I don't understand that. The firm of Richardson Tierney, I don't know what you're talking about, copyright whatever, but Richardson Tierney is the general consultant for the State Board of Investment. They also review and critique various issues that the staff is facing. They are a resource for us and researching and looking at various projects, and they also meet individually with board members without staff there to review whatever issues are in front of the board, either in a board folder or just whatever general topics they have. So they are, again, another step in the due diligence review process of policy formulation in the State Board of Investment.
So they're not listed. Are they listed on the State Board of Investment? I've been told that they're not listed on the State Board of Investment website as an official advisor of the board.
Madam Chair, they sure are in the annual report, and if they're not on the website, we'll put them there. I am not a website professional, but they obviously have been part of the State Board of Investment for a while.
Okay, well...
I mean, there's nothing to hide about them. I mean, I don't understand whether we're talking...
Well, our experts from the Pension Commission said, for example, that they were only aware of one report from Richardson Tierney in November 2008, which is a set of PowerPoint slides on an asset liability study, and that was copyrighted by Richardson Tierney, and distribution was prohibited. So I guess that's not in the annual report then, or it is?
Well, Madam Chair, if it's, I didn't know that there was any copyright, and believe me, if there is any issue, it won't be an issue. They'll make copies if you'd like. Public documents.
Okay. What happened, the topic that you and I talked about years and years ago, that what happened with the KKR investment?
Madam Chair and members, we still have some investments with KKR. They continue to do relatively well for us. I think our average internal rate of return with KKR is in the high teens, net. So they've done okay for us.
Madam Chair, if you could just elucidate for some of the...
That's the barbarian education.
Again, Madam Chair, if you could elucidate for those members.
It's a long story, but it's a good book. I didn't get it from the library.
I don't have a follow-up on KKR. And not directly on Richard and Tierney. I guess I need kind of a back-to-the-basics review. So you have various people giving you feedback and advice on decisions that you have made, and that's a good thing, diversity of opinion. But I guess I'm not totally clear on what kinds of directions you provide. Are you basically selecting managers, and then you're making decisions on which managers to go to, or allocations, and then you find managers for that allocation? Or do you direct specific trades or movements for the managers as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, first of all, we have established an asset allocation policy. And we have to establish a policy and how we will implement each piece of that. In other words, how much passive, how much active, how much risk control. Then, once you've established that, you retain managers to fill in those various slots within your asset allocation. I mean, that was accomplished 20-some years ago, and it's an ongoing process. I mean, the asset allocation has changed over time, the manager configuration has changed over time, and that has been an ongoing process with dialogue among the staff, the Investment Advisory Council, the consultant, and the board, and other parties.
Madam Chair, follow-up. So you don't really engage in decisions about specific trades, or there's nobody in your staff that does that. You just select the people who make the portfolio decisions?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, for the pension-related assets, that's true. We do run money in some... We run a $5 billion cash management pool internally for all the state's general revenue funds, the highway funds, and other funds. We run approximately $800 million bond portfolio internally for non-pension-related assets like environmental trust funds and so on and so forth. And we also run approximately $1 billion equity portfolio that's basically an S&P 500 index fund internally. So we do run a fair amount of assets internally for various legal and IRS reasons. We cannot commingle retirement and non-retirement assets. So the retirement-related assets is basically all run with external managers. The non-retirement assets is for the most part run by internal staff.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. I just want to go back to the fee issue. I understand now from what you said earlier, you don't pay on a transaction-by-transaction basis. You pay these managers. And you said that overall, your overall overhead is 0.1% or thereabouts. How are those managers though paid? Are they paid an annual fee, a flat fee? Are they paid based on performance? I guess I'm just wondering how those folks are paid.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon, most of our managers, fixed income managers, are paid on a flat fee. Most international managers are paid on a flat fee. Most of our domestic equity managers, because we believe we have better bogeys or customized indexes against them, are paid on a performance-based fee. So their fees can go higher or can go considerably lower based upon their performance.
I just wondering, do they pay us now for the privilege of working for us?
Madam Chair, Representative Kipman, we have actually had two managers say it.
Okay. I didn't know I could get that little treasure out of it. And a simple. I doubt it's going back the other way as well as it went. But nonetheless, I do want to mention, too, I think that in regards to Richard and Tierney, that they were more of an advisor to the board as an assistant to the board to help in regards to that's not our area necessarily of expertise. So a lot of that was helping to be a second in balance, where the Investment Advisory Council was very much of a support to the staff and helping to give oversight, and it's very much a second in balance amongst them all. And it's a rigorous process. Even to get in the door to be considered, you go through an extremely thorough, strong vetting process before you're even considered, and then it's competitive after that. There are always several for any one area whatsoever. And I always was amazed sometimes you had to really, really be persistent to kind of come to that, and I appreciate that aspect of it, and it was very important to us as a board to make sure that that process was there, because there is no way when you're managing that many billions and billions of dollars that you could ever actually have that kind of oversight. So you really were. So the balance between all of them is very important, and I think but mainly especially in regards to Richard and Tierney. So they didn't so much develop reports or per se or things like that. They would read them, oversee them, meet with the board ahead of time during the issues or questions, but they weren't hired for necessarily doing that. And matter of fact, do Richard and Tierney receive compensation for what they do? That is a competitive contract basis?
Madam Chair and Representative Kipmeyer, yes, that is a RFP process.
Okay, I assume that you didn't, but I don't know what stopped you from doing. How did you not get involved with Mr. Madoff, for example?
This is, Madam Chair, one of our ongoing debates at the Investment Advisory Council. I have a number of members of the Investment Advisory Council who like hedge funds, and I have been quoted in the press as the antichrist of hedge funds, and I am not a supporter of hedge funds, and Mr. Madoff ran a hedge fund. We have zero money in hedge funds.
So that was what you... So it didn't impress you that David Swensen moved the Yale endowment from $1.2 billion to $22 billion in, I don't know, 10 years or so?
I know. Mr. Swensen and others have done a very good job, but they are having some issues right now. And, you know, and Mr. Swenson's done a very good job. He's also done it with a fair amount of leverage, which, to be honest with you, for a state fund, it's illegal.
Okay. So, if you knew all these things that were wrong about Mr. Madoff, why didn't you tell everyone else?
Madam Chair, I never even went and seen Mr. Madoff. He deals in a different world than I participate.
Okay. Just to follow up on this issue of fees and transactions and so on, as you know, I have an interest in the question of divestment. And so following through, if I guess we could take a real-life example of the Sudan, where this legislature essentially created a policy, we passed a law that created a new investment policy. Obviously, managers of the index portfolio and the actively managed portions weren't making that decision, and you weren't hiring somebody who was going to make that decision. That was basically a directive that came from the state. So how did that kind of get processed through your portfolio? Or how does that happen?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, for example, with the Sudan legislation, there was a specific list of stocks that was affected. We provide all of our managers with a list of prohibited securities. And if they own those securities in compliance with the Sudan legislation, I don't recall the exact, but I think they had like 90 days to sell half of it and 150 to sell it all, or I don't remember, but there was some stage period. So we monitored, make sure that they got to where they had to be in compliance with law. Now, you know, the reality is at that point in time, the legislature has, in my opinion, alleviated the State Board of Investment of its fiduciary responsibilities that relates to those individual securities. You know, and we have the same issue with Iran. You know, we will be talking more about that, I believe, at the Pension Commission on Friday. And, you know, we've had some discussions about, you know, whether we should, you know, if liquidation is the proper way, or for shareholder resolutions is a better proposal, or whatever. But, you know, if that legislation passed, that legislation is different, and in my opinion, significantly different than the Sudan legislation, because it also has a paragraph in that it basically says that the State Board of Investment believes that liquidating these stocks would breach its fiduciary responsibility, and the board doesn't have to do it. Now, you know, at that point in time, the legislature is no longer taking over the fiduciary responsibility as it did in the Sudan legislation, and really making the board make those decisions. You know, again, the legislature obviously has the ability to do what it would like, but it's much cleaner legislation. If you want us to liquidate those stocks and that's how it goes, so be it. Or if we want to look at shareholder resolutions, so be it, or whatever. But Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, that's one of the issues that we're looking at.
Can I?
Yes.
I'm just wondering about, though, this issue of the transaction cost of doing it. I guess beyond the companies that we mentioned as it relates to the Sudan, how long is the list of prohibited securities? I mean, and is there, if we're paying on the international side, which would be the case for Iran, a flat fee for the management, is there additional fee on top of that because the state directed the trades, or is it the market reaction that causes the what expense might be there? I guess I'm just wondering about how the transaction is paid for when the state is directing a specific list of prohibited securities.
Madam Chair and Representative, whenever a trade takes place, there's cost. There's commission and there's market impact. The difference here is that the legislature would be directing that trade to take place. The manager may have not sold that stock to the next plan, but the legislature is saying that this stock or this list of stocks will be sold over this specific period. So once you have directed them to do it, you effectively have forced that transaction and forced that cost. Now, that cost will effectively be borne by the manager and by the money under his or her control. But there will be costs.
Madam Chair, just so then, Mr. Baker, just to make sure I understand, so it would, you know, certainly there's the market effect, but as far as the transaction fees, that is, as it were, included as part of the management, the flat fee for the in the index side.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, when a manager does a trade with Merrill Lynch, he will pay a commission, a couple cents a share, and there will be market impact. Those costs are paid effectively by the money under the management of that manager. The manager doesn't pay it out of the management fee that we pay them. They pay it out of the underlying asset. So effectively, you are reducing the value of the assets when you incur costs that are directed for other than investment purposes.
Has the State Board of Investment done anything in terms of shareholder resolutions? And I know CalPERS has at various times. Has Minnesota ever done that?
Madam Chair and members, we have done a fair number of shareholder resolutions over the years. There's legislation on the books that we should annually sponsor or co-sponsor shareholder resolutions as it relates to Northern Ireland. We have initiated shareholder resolutions related to pharmaceutical companies. We have re-initiated shareholder resolutions related to tobacco companies. And we've co-sponsored other various resolutions. Yes, we have done that. Now, in all fairness...
Is that covered in the annual report?
Yes, it is.
Oh.
And in all fairness, though, all of the shareholder resolutions that we have done have been done domestically. We have not done them internationally, which would be the case if a shareholder resolution alternative was enacted along with the Iran legislation. We are doing our research right now about how that can get done. From what we understand, it can get done. It's just going to be some work, and that's what we're looking at.
Okay. Are there any other questions? I would like to move to Mr. Stolte, who would talk to us about asset allocation. And are there any other, if you'd like to stay around in case there are questions after his presentation. And are there any other questions, Representative Kiffler?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think about the only thing, it's just another comment. One of the most amazing things is when you would pass some of these resolutions and you would take some of these actions, it's $100 million or 20% of the company. So many times, for us who generally have a few shares or something like that, this is a realm where market effect and especially public decisions, when people know you're going to be forced into a sell, and you're doing some of those things, and you have these kind of positions, it has an effect beyond what each of us usually deal with on an individual basis. My few shares are not going to affect the market. But I think in these situations, and most pension companies in general deal with these, especially when they're public, because their decisions are public and has a public effect, as well as any action they take does as well on the financial side. I just thought it might be helpful to add that.
Well, I think some of the ones that CalPERS have done with on workers' rights and things like that. I'm not completely sure right now, but okay. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Vicker, I appreciate your position vis-a-vis fiduciary responsibility and performance of the funds. And so I think I know where you would go with this question, but I'll skip the question and go to asking what other states do vis-a-vis their funds, their investment boards and their investment funds, and leveraging those for further investment in their own states or in their own communities. For instance, do some use the weight of those investments to back up loan guarantees or credit enhancements, or even I believe that California and other states earmark a portion or require a percentage of the total investment portfolio to be invested in state. If you could just give us a kind of an overview and your feeling about those steps.
Madam Chair and Representative, as far as in-state investing, first of all, you know, we're in Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota. We try to do what we can here. We have done a number of Minnesota venture capital fund deals. So, you know, we try to do what we can here prudently. As far as California, as far as I know, they don't require certain amounts of their assets to be invested in state. But they have done a number of things in state, including losing $1 billion on real estate outside of LA. The whole fund went away and they had $1 billion in the plan. So, you know, it can be good, it can be bad. As far as anybody backing up a loan guarantee, I am not familiar with any fund that's done that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vicker, other states that have done significant in-state or in-jurisdiction investments?
Madam Chair, Representative, to my knowledge, no. There are some that would say they have because they have invested in venture capital organizations within their state. We have done that, too. I mean, we're fortunate that the venture capital community in the Twin Cities is actually a pretty vibrant venture capital community. I mean, venture capital is basically, you know, in Silicon Valley. It's out in Route 128 out in Boston, and then it's kind of all over. And Minnesota has had a pretty good venture capital community. We have probably done at least a half a dozen venture capital deals in Minnesota. So we are trying to do what we can for them here.
And Madam Chair, annual report?
Absolutely, it'll be listed.
One complaint I've had about the annual report is that there isn't an executive summary. Is there an executive summary in this one?
No.
What can we do to get one? For those of us who...
Well, there is a summary up front of a lot of things. There's a lot more detail as you go deeper into the report.
Okay. Well, I would like to get to Mr. Salty, and you know, we may have other opportunities to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming. I probably shouldn't say this to totally destroy the credibility of this person before he starts speaking. Someone who is equally admired by me and former Representative Phil Crinkley. So you can know that he's going to do a good job in whatever he's talking about.
Madam Chair and members, I will try to hustle through a PowerPoint.
I know, we never have enough time.
And before I lead off,
you need to say who you are for the case.
Mike Schulte, old retired guy, supposedly.
Okay.
Did a time at 3M. I think I did at 3M what Jeff has done at Target and maybe other places too. in that process of reporting to the 3M board, it became clear to me early on that they were attributing all the gains that resulted from the pension fund investing process, attributing it all to the money managers. It became clear to me that their own policy was driving the results. So I decided to decompose the total rate of return, that is just a percentage number, and break it into decision groups so that one could isolate what's working and what isn't in the investment process, all the way from policy setting to the other extreme of stock picking and manager portfolio. So that was the purpose of my development of that system. And so I have never heard reference to Richards and Tierney as often in years as I have today. They say that imitation is the highest form of flattery, so I'll accept that. Dave Tierney was at Amoco when I was invited to Washington to present this whole value-added concept that you're going to see in a minute. And Dave left Amoco and developed a very thriving organization. I say that because it means that the recommendation I'm going to make toward the end of this time period will probably be supported by the people who preceded me here, because it's the same concept and they've adopted it. So let's go on from here. This is just a simple little diagram that says if you start out with $100 million, you're probably going to end up with more than 196 if you can just plug the leaks that are represented by this little pipeline through which all the money flows. It could be a pretty direct shot with indexing by indexing the policy components to the extent that they can be, and that's almost all of them. So closing out those leaks would probably, in my experience, boost that 196 by at least $10 million over a 10-year period. I want to show very quickly some charts. These represent the 8 largest funds in the state after SBI. And what you see here is a condensation of a, call it Richardson tyranny or Mike Schulte attribution analysis. You can ignore the left-hand bar. It's all about net cash flow, benefits out, contributions in. If they just rolled T-bills, took no risk at all, they'd get the second bar. Not wise. Diversified over asset classes that have some risk associated with them, stocks and bonds, almost always, historically, is added value, except for short periods like we're going through right now. Focus on the last bar because that is the optional one. Every fund could stop at the dashed line and just index their investment policy. Now let's just see how many of these eight funds added value in the last bar through active management, net of their own fees, and their own mistakes. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. How many were green?
What is this a particular year?
This is a 10-year period. Should have said that. Should have been. It's a 10-year period, and it does not include the last two, or we wouldn't have nice green bars here to talk about.
Okay.
So, how many were green out of that on that in that last bar? 1 out of 8. In my 30-some years of experience, that is just about. This is a very small sample, but it's right about on the mark of how many institutional funds, pension funds of any size, actually add value by all of the rigmarole they go through to hire and fire managers and pick and choose asset class styles, large cap, small cap, and all of those things. So the point is that if we added up all those red bars and gave credit for that one green one, have about a negative $235 million over that 10-year period.
Mr. Schulte, I don't need a rigorous analytical regressive regression analysis answer to my question, but anytime you do a statistical analysis like this, it's about kind of what's your frame and what's externalized and what's internalized. If you could just assuage my concern about leaving the last 2 years off, sort of saying, you know, this is the question: is this a corrective period, or was the last 10 years really a true bubble that we won't see ever again? If you could just assuage my concern about that, generally.
First to answer, Madam Chair, Representative. First of all, the last 2008 isn't available. That's one of my concerns, is that there's a significant delay in the reporting of information from the funds. Now, these fellows you just talked to are already up to date. It's only a couple of months after the end of the year. We wait another year or so for volunteer firefighters and the rest. So I did not intentionally leave out the last 2 years to avoid that. My expectation is that we could very well be in for the same kind of 17-year period workout that we went through from 1965 to 82. Given the leverage, the overwhelming audacity that was represented in Wall Street in recent years, it's going to take a while to work that off. Wouldn't be surprised if we're still looking at Dow 12,000 8 years from now, trying to work our way through the morass and left behind. So, this, as I said, was about 200. Yes, ma'am?
One more question.
Do
you want to?
If I could.
Okay, let's get this question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's get it done.
For the delegated decisions, orange bar, is that what the incremental value add is compared to just having invested in the primary policy strategy, or are you saying that if you had invested in the primary policy strategy you would have made money, and had you just delegated it you would have lost money? I'm really struggling to believe that it would be that sharp a contrast.
Madam Chair, Representative. I didn't make something clear in my haste here. Here you have to visualize the sum of assets on the left side of the chart and a larger sum on the right side. These are each four incremental pieces that account for the difference, the growth in the fund. All the growth in the fund essentially came from the green bars, the policy. And you could just take those two bars and put them together because the risk-free and the risk-taking portions could be just stacked up and say there's the total return. The delegated decisions are those delegated to staff, management, outside consultants, and the like. And the only reason to cross that dashed line is to add value to what you already have available to you. So in 7 out of 8 times, that didn't happen. But there were plenty of fees paid for failure. Now, to show how that becomes significant, here is the Minneapolis Teachers Fund, which doesn't exist anymore. But 2 years ago, when the Taxpayers Association had me run the numbers and update this report from 1994 that Mark Dayton had done, to bring that up to date, we get this result. Now, I notice I stacked the policy bar there. The delegated decisions in this fund reduced the fund by about almost $700 million over a 23-year period. That's less than 1% a year negatively compounded to produce a number like that. Notice how steadily that fund eroded behind its own policy. This is not to pass judgment on the investment policy. That's the given. Its implementation and hiring and firing managers that produced this result. Now, notice that back in 1992 or so, when this report was first done, they were under by $160 million. The problem could have been intercepted at that point. It was not, so it compounded to be something substantially larger. Now it's merged away, but of course it took with it about $1 billion of unfunded liability that somebody's going to have to work off over time. But this kind of the evolution of value lost, or more hopefully value added, is observable month by month, quarter by quarter, so you can see which parts of the process are failing, and this can be subdivided 4 ways. I just put it all together and counted it delegated decisions in the aggregate. So the investment management process, and I hold this up as the Bible. This is the prudent investment practices as described by the Center for Fiduciary Studies in Pittsburgh, and they are probably the preeminent educator for fiduciaries in charge of funds of this kind. Several obligations on the part for fiduciaries, but the key ones are: formalize an investment policy, implement it diligently, and then monitor the process. And it's the failures to adequately monitor the process that leads to these extended, compounded, negative results. And the top ERISA attorney in the country, by most accounts, argues that the weakest link in the investment management process is the failure to monitor effectively. Oftentimes you see a couple of percentage points together. One is the benchmark, one is the actual result. It might be a few couple of basis points or even a percentage point behind. But it doesn't register until you see the dollar impact, and you just saw that. One of the reasons it's tough to monitor is that we first violate the first principle, a formalized policy. Now, I don't want to pick on this particular fund, but it happens that the Taxpayers Association chose three to examine beyond the state, the Minneapolis teachers. Minneapolis Police was one, St. Paul teachers, Bloomington Fire. But if you look at the policy as it's changed over time, something stands right out. Back in 96, there were no benchmarks. How would you measure, how would you monitor their progress without appropriate benchmarks? In 2002, they introduced benchmarks, but notice, large cap, small cap, growth, value, and believe it or not, international equity benchmarked against the S&P 500. This is not effective monitoring. There's no way you could legitimately calculate a value added or lost from that kind of policy start. So my concern has been for a long time that we really don't have very much fiduciary responsibility being carried out beyond the very largest funds in the state. Bloomington Fire, what would you make of that if you were trying to monitor them, or if they themselves are monitoring themselves? The last column is mine. I had to punt in a couple of percentages to make some sense out of it based on how they were actually positioned. But notice, what kind of benchmark is maximum 85%? Maximum of what? Maximum Russell 1000, S&P 500, any number of benchmarks could be in there, but they're absent. So I don't want to dwell on this, but at the very bottom they offer four different equity benchmarks. Which one are they really using? We don't know. Here's a couple of pieces from the state auditor's files. This is the way they're maintained. You see on the left side is a code of some kind that stands, as you see in the second column, for bond stocks, international, and whatever. What do we make of mixed assets? What kind of mix? What percentage mix? Mix of what subclasses or styles? We really can't tell from this at all. Now, drilling down, we can put a name somewhere on each one of those mixed assets, but nowhere were we able, out of the state auditor's office, to pull benchmarks for those, even if we identified the money manager. Notice that right-hand past the dashed line that can be broken down into tactical policy, implementation, selection of managers, and so on. A great overlooked opportunity is the tactical policy, which often is the primary policy here, could just as well be called strategic, more often is. But tactically, think of what would have happened if people in the last couple of years would have been wise enough and free enough to deviate from policy as the market reached this crescendo of debt and derivative generated, hedge fund generated increases in value. It was a pretty temporary thing, as we have found out. But the opportunity, and I don't know that SBI has it, the opportunity to, at obvious moments, and there may be only that obvious a moment every 15 years or so, on those occasions there really ought to be freedom to tactically deviate down from the equity exposure that's in the policy. And if that has been done even 10 or 20% percentage points, that tactical policy bar would have gone green as the primary bar shrank under the weight of the market decline. Information required to produce this kind of information is minimal. It's like looking at your checking account statement. Beginning balance, what'd you put in, what'd you take out, what's the new balance? The difference with investment accounts is that it doesn't just get you to from beginning to end by pluses and minuses of additions and subtractions. There's a gap, and that's the performance gap. Pretty easy to calculate whatever that difference is based on an appropriate asset base, time weighted. Excuse me. Leaves you with the accounting for the difference, and it's that difference that becomes the value added or lost that we're trying to calculate if given the number. The beauty of it is that the administrator that has control of this system can drill down to the manager level and find out whether the market, whether the manager is adding any value through his own decision. To the left of the dashed vertical line, that's the policy at work, or the piece of the policy assigned to this manager. Manager has two ways to beat the market. Market timing, cherry picking and stuff. Didn't make it either way in this particular case, but got a couple $1 million for trying. So the fee is always there when it's asset based. I like to hear what I did before, that there's some performance based fee arrangement at SDI. You're not going to find that anywhere else in the state, probably, with maybe a few rare exceptions. There's a lot of money out here that's exposed to this drag from Wall Street. And if you just look at that very top number, state and local pensions, $2.6 billion, or trillion, I should say, doesn't look like much until you really write it out there. And if just one basis point of shortfall occurs, you're really moving this thing to just taking three zeros away there, and you have $2.6 billion and that's a year. So there's a lot of money left on the table in the nation's retirement system. That's the end of that set of slides, but I'd make some more comments and welcome your interruptions with questions anytime you like. But again, the theme of this is less is more. Less decision making, fewer money managers, less redundant accounting, less redundant auditing, far less burden on the state auditor's office to gather up all of this data and put it into files that are unrecognizable, actually, except to them. If I would argue that at least one member of every fiduciary group in managing estate funds ought to be formally educated to be a fiduciary, to know what the responsibilities are. There needs to be transparency for the public to understand. I suggest that the public has a far greater chance of understanding what's happening to them if they aren't given a couple of numbers that are a fraction of a percentage point apart, but rather told, $80 million this year is what it costs us to play this game, then I think they might rise up and say, I think we can find a better place for that $80 million, given the state budget and given the national budget. There's free money. Less means don't do it if you can't do it well. More means there's more value when you quit doing it. So this sounds a little preachy, but after 35 years of watching this game play on, one gets a little impatient about it, and you also get old enough so that you don't care.
I do think we have a question from Mr. Downey, and then I do think the auditor's been looking agitated, and I think he wants to make some comments, even though we're going a little late. But Mr. Downey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the definition of these delegated management decisions, to be sure, that would include, I think, the fund managers embedded within some over-the-market mutual fund or something. And I'm assuming that it would also include the managers that you might hire to manage the fund allocations and distributions. And so am I right in interpreting your advice that an organization with as large an investment pool as we have at SDI, that they would have their own staff investment managers, they would kind of build their own portfolio and manage the kind of direct equity transactions themselves as compared to kind of outsourcing any of that management decision making to these other fund managers? Is that's your model, your recommended model?
That's my model only for everybody else. I believe SDI is perfectly capable of negotiating very low fees, as they've evidenced, perfectly capable. They have the power to hold these managers' feet to the fire in a way that the other eight and the other 700 volunteers do not. So all of these remarks are really aimed below SBI. Now, SBI has a lot of money. I think there's a report, I think I noticed the 4 basis points per year for 10 years was a shortfall. Well, 4 basis points on, say, $20 million of equity assets is, what, $80 million? Maybe, if my quick math is right. And that doesn't suggest that should or ought to have been avoided, because there's another part of the fund that's in international and private equity and so on that may partially offset that. But it's very difficult for a fund of $40 billion to come out ahead consistently. That isn't to say that I'm making any criticisms whatever of the way that operation is managed, because it's probably as good as any in the country. But what bothers me more is that only one state, Pennsylvania, has more pension funds than Minnesota. I suggest that if the Taxpayers Association, if the system the Taxpayers Association put in place, which is essentially a Richards and Tierney accountability system, if that were mandated for those 700 funds out there, I think you would see two things: a rush to the SBI managed funds, which are much more low cost than anything they're getting out there now. It will drive the minions of Wall Street kind of out of the path, because they will, especially if they're compensated on value added, most of them won't even take the job. If you said, we'll pay you 20% of all the value added you can generate over our policy, I think you would find 80% of all the money managers in the country say thanks, but no thanks. They'd rather get the fee based on assets so that they're sure of something and let the performance fall where it will. Until they get terminated. But once the manager is terminated, it's almost always because they have underperformed. That underperformance is locked in. The new manager that takes over the residual assets isn't responsible for filling in the hole left behind and then adding value. They're only concerned about looking good for themselves with the assets they're given right up front. So that permanent hole continues to miss all the future rebounds in the market, and therefore he falls further and further behind what would have been there without. If I could just conclude, I would say I really believe that there needs to be fiduciary standards demanded of those 700 funds out there. Once you demand it, and in this age of digital, they can take maybe an hour every month and update their own files electronically, have them available to the state auditor's office, without the state auditor having to dig it out and key it in or whatever they do to obtain to get the numbers in the pot. So get the fiduciary standards established. Get some transparency through a value-added system that the Taxpayers Association has laid right on the table. And I will add, I have not personally, even though I've put the intellectual capital into it, not taken one dime at any time for the establishment of that system. And it's ready to go. All it takes is for some organization in the state, possibly your own, to stand up and say, let's do it. FBI believes in showing the dollars of value added or lost. Why isn't that especially demanded of the less capable people out there? And I would think you would also see that not only would they be driven to the FBI's menu of choices, which covers the globe, but you would also see a virtual implosion in that 700 number. I would expect you to, I think a dozen aggregated pension funds would get the job done, and it makes really very little sense for the firefighters in one town to be 10% in equities, and 20 miles down the road they're 80% in equities, when they're all trying to accomplish the same purpose. Okay. Makes no sense.
We may bring you back for a roundtable discussion at some time. I do believe, do you want to say anything, Rebecca? Or no? What? Yes. We do have another committee coming in, but we do need to have an...
Madam Chair, I went over my...
No, no, that's okay. Everyone always does. We go over the time. We're the problems of doing that.
Can I have the bill, please? Madam Chair, members, I'm Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor. I came today as a fiduciary of the State Board of Investment. I was curious because I am very concerned about the markets right now, and was interested to hear what was being said. It turns out now it's about fire relief associations. That's a different issue. But I wanted to tell you, as a fiduciary of the State Board of Investment, that I have to go to pension conferences and investment conferences as a fiduciary for my continuing education. And the good thing that I can tell you is, as I travel the state, and you know, you talk about prudent investment practices, I have to do this as a fiduciary to make sure that we are doing what we're supposed to, and that I ask all the questions because my rear end is on the line. Pardon my French. And so I have to make sure we're doing due diligence. We do more due diligence than probably almost any state, I think I can say with confidence. And whenever I come back to Minnesota, I always say, thank goodness for the system that we have set up, because we have so many safety nets and layers. And people like Jeff Bailey, who are willing to serve on the Investment Advisory Council, again, we're very fortunate. We have some incredibly impressive people who are actively working in this field, who do have good debates and discussions. We've got so anyway, all I want to say is that the process is very, very good. The question of monitoring, it occurs regularly in state board investment. So if it's not about state board investment and it started morphing into the volunteer plans, a couple of things, you know, the fire relief associations, we do oversee them as an office. We don't have boxes and boxes of things people dig through. They report online electronically. We've moved them to that. And since I've been in the office, we've had a working group to continue to help these folks to simplify laws so they follow the rules, to help them be successful in the first place, to make sure they understand their fiduciary duty. Now, the way they're set up legislatively is a legislative issue. But my take on it is, I think they're going to be here for a while, so I'm going to work to make them the best they can be, and we do regular trainings. They're very interested in market concerns right now. Our next training sessions will deal with market concerns, investments, and all those things. And so legislatively, if you decide you want to make some changes, that's your purview. But we do work with them. We have a very good relationship in terms of educating them and doing a constant stream of information and education. And Mr. Vickers has been very happy to assist if they want it, to have discussions about investment and the option of investing through State Board of Investment. And he's been, you know, very, he said, I'll go wherever they need me. So we try to help them, again, make good decisions. But they are fiduciaries in the way the law is set up right now. There is transparency. We have had many discussions with Mr. Stolte. We've had lots of data requests, but not exactly data requests. He doesn't exactly know what he wants, and that's been a difficulty. And so we've given him what we have. Sometimes he wants numbers that are not out there because they're not required to be reported or information that's just not required. And they're a very specialized group. But I have incredibly competent staff, and my pension division director is here. Rose Hennessy Allen has worked in the division for years. So I just wanted to provide some clarification on this issue, and so again, it's up to you. But the State Board of Investment we have, I would say, one of the best systems. We tend to be conservative in our approach, and Howard has been. And Howard told stories before about how some of the states got really aggressive, and then they got bitten. And Howard's been very, very, very careful. So remembering a lot of this money is retirees' money, and they need it. And I hope that we're really careful as a state right now in terms of doing anything, because we've experienced losses. So I appreciate you allowing me to speak. I don't know if you have any questions for me.
Well, I think we seem to have had a universal accolade for the State Board of Investment. So I think that that isn't a problem. And we also are aware, at least from the Pension Commission, and it will eventually come here, of the really good work that you and Ms. Hennessy have done with the volunteer firefighters, and in terms of setting up a system where it looks like we're going to have a consolidation into one fund. And it looks like over the years since I first started looking at this, we certainly have a lot more of them using the State Board of Investment. So I think things are going along in a reasonably good pace. The question is there something else we should be looking at, and could it go faster? But I think the bill that we're hopefully passing this year will probably advance that. I'm sorry, I know we always get to the end and it gets even more interesting, but maybe we'll have, if people want to continue discussions on investment policy and learning about the market and other things, maybe we'll come back after we get our bills out and things like that. But thanks everyone for participating in this, and I think we'll the annual report is supposedly in all of our mailboxes, and we'll get some more information out. I'm sorry, we've been held up so often by other committees that I guess we can hold up a following committee once in a while. Okay, meeting adjourned.